Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow at Bruegel and Europe columnist for Reuters Breaking Views. I am delighted to be here today with Chiara Criscuolo, head of the Productivity, Innovation, and Entrepreneurship Division of the OECD, and also Reinhilde Wergelers, who is a professor at the University in Leuven and another senior fellow here at Bruegel. We are here to talk about green industrial policy and how we can take that forward within the policy community. Chiara, can you set the stage for us a little bit about where we stand and what we're looking at?
Let me start with two points that I think are important. First of all, I think there has been a general switch in the acceptance of the role of industrial policies and in particular innovation policies in the whole policy debate right now. I think for many years we talked about industrial policies are the policy that shouldn't have been named. And I think now there is a general recognition that we need some form of government, I would say, intervention, perhaps more than before, to really accelerate the change towards climate neutrality. We have some very important targets to meet. And in a way, when we think about industrial policy, especially targeted towards innovation and diffusion of existing technologies, there needs to be a recognition that if we are to achieve the climate neutrality goals, the ones that we set by 2030, but mainly the ones that we set ourselves for 2050, all sectors of the economy must switch to low carbon technologies. And so we need to act in two directions: the deployment of mature green technologies that need to accelerate, but we also need new breakthrough, let me call them green innovations. And so we need to support different, I would say, stages of the innovation cycle. We need to support mature technology. We need to support, you know, market uptake of existing technology, but also we need to support technology that are still under development. So in a way, supporting research, development and demonstration is actually key. Why do I say this? Because I think there has been a silver lining to the COVID pandemic, if I may say so. It's always hard to find a silver lining to this, but I think the fiscal packages that have been put forward and the green dimension, the climate neutrality dimension of these fiscal packages has been very important in really going in the right direction. So, if you want, I stop and I let Reinhilde go because I know I'm talking for long already.
No, I just like to emphasize what you're saying is really a very fundamental challenge of green industrial policy. So indeed, innovation will be a very important part of the green industrial policy perspective here, both in terms of creating new innovative solutions for tackling the climate change challenge, but also the adoption of existing technologies and the diffusion here. And that's for me also a very fundamental challenge that we're facing here, is how to get that balance right. Because, of course, because of the urgency, we definitely also need to have a fast diffusion of existing technologies as much as possible. And the market itself will not go fast enough. So that's why we definitely need policy support for that. But the more we support existing technologies and the diffusion, basically we're taxing or we're making it more difficult for new technology solutions here, because they will have to compete with something that's been supported here. And that balance is really very essential. And I see now it's going way too much in the direction of, okay, because of urgency, we want particularly existing technologies that we know that works in order to support that. But we still need to balance this correctly with also supporting new technology solutions that are very highly risky, with high risk of failure here, but which could be potential breakthroughs in the future here. And we need to invest on that in time. And definitely we need even more policy support for those kind, because the market failures are even bigger for that here. So I really liked, Chiara, what you mentioned there, this dichotomy between these two parts of the dimension. That's really the challenge we're facing.
Chiara, you mentioned support and you mentioned fiscal packages. Reinhilde, does that mean money from governments? And how much are we talking about?
That definitely also means money here, because we will need to support these technologies here with subsidies or tax credits, that's for sure. Also, the procurement instruments may be important, but also that will be part of the fiscal policy here. And it's not just only how much money, but also how much risk are we willing to take here. So that's also the whole debt structure is therefore also important here.
And so when you say risk willing to take, you mean governments absorbing losses, or you just mean choosing products that could fail, or both?
Technologies and projects that could fail, yeah.
I'm fully in agreement. And perhaps let me add 3 points to what Reinhilde just said and your question, Rebecca, which is how much money are we talking about? You were asking how the OECD could help. We actually have 2 recent studies where we try to quantify how much government are spending. And in particular, do we see a change in how much money governments are spending on green? And the answer is we see an increase, which is good news, in the overall industrial strategies of countries. And here, let me mention one thing. We talk about giving money, but I think when we think about industrial strategy, it is important to think of it as a coherent set of government support. So yes, financial, yes, fiscal support, but I think the whole competitive environment, framework condition, you know, is it easy to open a startup? Is it easy to grow? How much regulatory barriers there are? You know, these are important aspects that need to be moving in the same direction of supporting new technologies, new green innovation, new market opportunities. Second, we also look at how much different countries are spending through these fiscal packages. And let me mention 2 points here, which I think are important. I think, you know, with the IRA, for example, the US really appears, when we look at it from an absolute point of
view. This is the US Inflation Reduction Act.
Yes, sorry about that. I should have said, you know, and you know, the announced spending was more than $600 billion, which is much larger than the second spending in our database, which is Italy with an $100 billion announced spending. But when I look at it relative to the GDP of the country, you see that there are many countries around the globe that actually spend a significant amount of relative to their GDP on these climate neutral technologies and this innovation. So just to say, I think there is a lot going on that is going in the right direction. Then the question comes, and this goes to the point that I think Reinhilde made, are we spending the money right? And I think that's a different question. And the reason why I say this is that we see that lots of these, for example, recovery package money is going to sectors like electricity producing, transport, and so on, and not so much to industry. So while we know that industry is responsible for quite a large share of carbon emissions, so I think there is a question, are we targeting the money right? The second point is the one that Reinhilde made. You know, we see a lot of advancement on the deployment of mature technologies, on adoption. We don't see enough money going to research development and demonstration. And in fact, when we look at the ratio of how much we are spending on support vis-a-vis development, we see that the ratio is 1 to 5. So for each dollar that we spend on research, development, and demonstration, we're actually spending $5 in terms of deployment, while the ratio, according to the literature, should be 1 to 2. So we are really not finding that right balance that Reinhilde was saying. And that is particularly important because we know that when you spend on research, development, and demonstration, through learning effects, through knowledge spillovers, we will get a much higher reduction in emissions, and we are going to get, you know, to our target of neutrality much faster. So I don't know if that goes in the direction, Reinhilde, of what you had in mind.
No, that's perfect. Yeah, I'm so happy that you say this and that you can also provide with the OECD evidence also some backup of this here, because otherwise might be hard to convince others for that. I also wanted to emphasize something else that you said. It's not just only about how much money is being spent, but also the other parts of the policy agenda here. So regulation, the regulatory agenda, setting missions and targets are also very important. A carbon price is very important. And all these elements, they are very complementary to subsidies and how much public support here. And the more stable and the more credible framework conditions that we have here, the more efficient any dollar that we will, or any euro that we will spend in terms of public funding to support research and particularly also development, will be so much more efficient if we also have these complementary policy instruments here. And that's why, for instance, we should not be too envious of the big amounts that the US is spending with the IRA here, because it doesn't have a carbon price, and that makes it much less efficient in terms of, so they need to spend really a lot of money to get the same kind of returns than we would have because we have these complementary instruments here. So really that part of your story too, Kira.
Kira, are your studies available to the public? Can we find them on your website?
Absolutely, and I'm happy to share them together with the podcast. I don't know if that's possible, but we have several studies. We also have data available online, and I should mention that most of these is also available in a chapter that we wrote for a volume that was edited actually by Bruegel, and you can find a lot of the evidence that I mentioned. But also one thing we didn't mention is the fact that I think the devil is in the detail when we design these type of policies, because, you know, we always think of untargeted, technology-neutral policy support. And I think, especially in the case of green technologies, and this is an example that we report in the chapter that we wrote for Bruegel's book, we see that, for example, if we use this technology-neutral support, we tend actually inadvertently to support more mature technologies. And that's why having a targeted, I would say, support for the more breakthrough technology is particularly important in the case of climate. And in the chapter, we make the example of the case of a policy that is in place in the Netherlands that basically, without meaning it, was supporting the more mature technologies, and actually the design change after a review that the OECD made of this policy. And now it's much more targeted towards more breakthrough, novel, radical innovations in this area.
I fully support your concerns, and I'm glad that you raised this here, because we know that there is a lot of bad dependency also, and incumbent players, even not necessarily on purpose, but of course they will be influencing quite a lot on how we design the details of the policy implementation, and having them really technology neutral for new technology options. I agree, the devil is in the detail, and it's not that easy. And that's why I also want to emphasize the importance of, so we don't know yet exactly what kind of policies actually will work, because it's pretty complex to get that right here. And that's why I think we definitely also need institutions like the OECD to be evaluating policy choices, because you have way more data across countries and across technologies, and you also have the capacity and the competences to do that here. But of course, that requires also that policymakers are willing to share the data on the policy instruments here with you. But that's really what we would need here, is just experiment with policy instruments here, but in a scientific fashion, so that we will be evaluating also and so that we can learn also as quickly as possible what works and what doesn't work.
When we come back, we'll talk more about how to build these targets and what worked and what hasn't, and what the OECD can teach us. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Kiara, can you talk to us about target building? We've talked so much about targets. And what does that mean? Are we setting aside ways to look for individual industries, amounts of money, amounts of carbon reductions? What are we setting a target for?
Okay, this is not the easiest question, because I think it depends on very much what we look at. I think for now we have one main target, which is carbon emission reductions, and that's what we should aim for. And as we said in the previous section, I think we still don't know what is the best technology to get there? And so I would say we have this target, and let me call it a really a societal goal in mind, and we have to use different trajectories to get there, different tools. We discussed some of them, carbon pricing, innovation, deployment, adoption, and we have to use different ways to get there. How much money we're spending, I think, will depend on both the cost of the technology, the efficiency of different government in using public fund, and also how fast the technology sort of work. And as we know, this is all a matter of experimentation and learning. So I would say the main target is climate neutrality. We set ourselves this target, and I think that's a good one to keep in mind when we take any policy decision.
Yep. That's definitely an important one. But I would like to add, because we're talking about not just green policy, but green industrial policy, that for this industrial policy component, because that adds an extra dimension right here. So we want to reach these green targets in a way that's as economically efficient and creates as much competitiveness as possible. So we also need some targets to know whether we are reaching those objectives in the most efficient way here. And there, I think we should be really careful in terms of what KPIs that we are using, because
it's a key performance indicator.
Right. Because the one you choose will actually set the scene. And if you pick a wrong one, you get the whole machine redirected in the wrong way here. And for me, what's really important is not necessarily how much public money that we are spending, but actually, can we incentivize the private sector to invest in green technologies here? So for me, the KPI would really be, do we leverage with our public funding, do we leverage private investments, do private firms have the right incentives to invest in the longer term here? If we don't reach that objective here, any kind of public policy will not be efficient in the longer term here. So that would be, for me, the KPI of the industrial policy component here. And what we see, for instance, in Europe in the Net Zero Industry Act and also in the US, there the target is more like how much can we produce locally here. And that, for me, is not the right target here, because that will also mean that we are compromising quite substantially in terms of how much decarbonization we will get if that would be the main target.
And why is that? Break that down for people. Why does local investment not necessarily align with decarbonization?
Well, if the local production doesn't have the most efficient way of doing it, then of course you're reaching these targets at a less economically efficient way here. And that means you pay in terms of decarbonization targets here, because you're not using the most efficient way or the best technologies that would be available globally in order to reduce the decarbonization target.
That's a fascinating point, because so much of the industrial policy focuses on strategic autonomy, on keeping clean technology at home. And what I hear you saying, Reinhilde, is that to help the planet, we really need to look worldwide at where it makes sense to manufacture things.
So we have to realize that some of these objectives may not always go in the same direction here. So strategic autonomy, we might have to pay a price in terms of less decarbonization, less efficiency here. And then I'm not saying that we should not go for strategic autonomy, but we should at least realize what the costs are in terms of the other objectives, and then choose the way that gives the least trade-off in terms of these other objectives here. And there I do think that innovation, again, can help us here, because with new technology solutions, we can actually read strategic autonomy in perhaps much more efficient long-term ways here that would also be positive in terms of decarbonization here. But it means pushing more the innovation machine for those new solutions.
I fully agree with Reinhilde, and perhaps let me mention two things. Additionality of industrial policy in this area is key, and as Reinhilde said, it is important that when we invest public money, private money follows, and that's something that, again, depends very much on the design of policy and on framework condition. But let me add one thing that links to the second point that Reinhilde made on local content. I mean, sometimes we want all to produce the clean technologies at home, but we might not have the right skills to do that, and the right infrastructure and the right resources. And so sometimes you want to achieve several goals, whether it's strategic autonomies, whether it's jobs in certain areas of your country for regional development purposes. But you need to take into account what your initial conditions are. Do you have the skills to open up a plant in a particular area? Because otherwise you basically are wasting your money because private investment will not come, even though you might give them very high tax incentives. If they don't have the right skills to produce sometimes very technologically intensive product, then you're not achieving the goal you have.
Can you give us some examples of products? Are we looking at heavy manufacturing? Are we looking at other manufacturing? Are we looking at computers, at services? What are we making here?
I think you have two ways of looking at this. One, you need to improve the processes that you have in place. And, you know, a lot of this is also adaptation and it's how you make things. And there again, you might need certain skills that you don't have. The second one, it might be new product, a new infrastructure. Think of hydrogen, green hydrogen. You need to have a particular infrastructure in place and again, create new processes to really develop this green hydrogen. And or you can think of renewable energy technologies, sort of wind turbines or solar panels and so on. And you know, there has been a big debate in the past on the support that has been given for the production of solar panels and, you know, whether this was a good thing because now we all have solar panels that are much cheaper, but these solar panels have been produced in a particular countries and Renilde might want to say more about this. And, you know, basically some countries have been subsidizing job and industrial development in other parts of the globe and not necessarily in their home country. So I think from a political point of view, that's a big challenge, I would say. And there is almost a trade-off, you know, the cost of the renewable enhancing technologies like solar panel and the creation of jobs in the home country.
Again, I fully support what Chiara is saying. We are very much aligned all the time. It's really a combination of looking at the whole process of how you produce goods and services and then also the new types of goods and services. And I think that also immediately emphasizes the importance of looking at the whole value chain and having actually not just looking at individual firms per se, but really at the whole value chain, also the suppliers and the customers here. They have to be really in networks connected so that you get also a very much more efficient product innovation cycle here. So that's emphasizing these networks and value chains.
So just to put a face on some of these goods and services, most of the examples Chiara gave are examples of how to make something that you can use to make electricity with a lower carbon footprint than the electricity that we make now using fossil fuels. So this is very important to the green transition, very important to have electricity created with greener sources. What other goods and services can we make? What are we going to do with that electricity, Reinhilde? Are we going to run our computers on it? Are we going to make other things? Is there a risk that we use that electricity to build plastic doodads that pollute the economy in different ways? Where does this electricity go and how does it get to the economy?
So electricity is really also a bit of a hub solution here that would really create much more possibilities to deliver mobility that depends on electricity or like if you think of electric vehicles. So there, of course, you need to have electricity, but also in terms of heating of buildings, also there through electricity, you can provide these services in a much more effective way here. So electricity is really the hub technology that allows also to deliver other services that used to be very CO2 unfriendly now in a way that's much more CO2 friendly because it's electrified and that electricity is produced in a clean fashion here.
Perhaps just to add to what Reinhilde said, I think there are also some very CO2 emitting sectors like steel and shipbuilding. They also will need to undergo a heavy transformation. And I mean, some of the hydrogen, for example, might help transforming this type of sector like steel producing or even shipbuilding that will have to switch to a greener type of fuel. We want to achieve climate neutrality by 2050. And that's something that the OECD is doing a lot of work on as well.
Yeah. And let me give you an example within the steel industry, how thinking more about process innovations you could actually help in this sector here. So the reason why steel is so very unfriendly is because it has to really produce at very high temperatures. If we can find new ways of processing metal and steel, and also different versions of steel and metal that don't require that high temperatures, then we also can really reduce substantially these energy costs here and electricity costs here. And that also creates opportunities for alternative technologies here that don't have to deliver that very high temperatures here. And so the whole thing of process and product innovations can really help also to address, like in steel industry, to make them much more CO2 neutral.
This is really interesting, and I really appreciate your both bringing out some of these examples for those of us who work a little bit farther away from the center of this. When we come back, we'll talk about policy innovations and ways to move things forward. Welcome back. I'm here with Chiara from OECD and Reinhilde from Bruegel, and we are talking about green industrial policy. I'd like to start this last section talking about innovation. One of the things that we hear a lot from business in Europe and outside of Europe is that the regulatory climate in Europe is not necessarily innovation friendly. And I would like to hear from you why business is so skeptical that innovation and Europe are two things that don't go together. What can Europe do to bring more of that innovation here and move things forward, given the interest in making these changes and meeting these targets?
I'm not so convinced that Europe is doing so badly. In general, of course, our innovation ecosystem, it's much less performing than the US. The US has a very bottom-up innovation system here that may need less push from regulation than Europe because we're lagging a bit behind on that. But in terms of regulation for green technologies, I think we're doing pretty well. First of all, we have the carbon price mechanism, and that's a long-term, very stable and consistent signal here. And the US is lacking that here. So it's not just only on regulation, but it's also providing really long-term consistent signals from regulation. Also, our targets and our missions are very much long-term because we have also much longer policy terms, seven-year programs here. So in that respect, I'm not so negative about Europe here. But of course, we have on the one hand regulation and directives, but then we have the implementation of this in the different member states here, and then we lose a lot of our strength here because of the fragmentation we still have here in terms of implementing the EU regulations and also of still complementing with national and regional, and particularly like, for instance, issues like permits for infrastructure and stuff like that. That's still very regionalized here. And so then the fragmentation really starts to play, and that's still a problem.
I love how you're talking about regulation as a force for good, as opposed to red tape as a blocking force, because we often hear those conversations happening in parallel and not at the same time.
Of course, bureaucracy and unnecessary complex regulation and unclear regulation is definitely a cost here. But we have to find a way, and that's why we actually need to constantly monitor what works and what doesn't work here, because it's very difficult ex ante to know did we get it right or not. And that's why we constantly have to monitor what works or not and adjust our regulation, but in a scientific fashion here. And not because if we keep on changing ad hoc all the time, then we lose the long-term stable window that we actually need here. So I think the private sector also needs to believe in the system we have at place in order to evaluate the regulation and whether we're changing or not.
So Chiara, what have you measured and what have we learned?
Just to add with what Reinhilde was saying, I mean, we were looking, for example, at different carbon pricing across countries. And this is something that, for example, we also mentioned in the chapter that I was referring to before, because, you know, we are talking a lot about what drives innovation and how regulation can affect innovation. And I think Reinhilde raises a very important point about long-term regulatory consistency, which is actually crucial for technology development. So it's really about the expectation, for example, of future carbon prices that is going to affect the innovation incentives of different firms. It's not what the price is today, but to credibly say, you know, governments across European Union and beyond need to credibly say, okay, we are going to raise the carbon prices. And that is going to be an important incentive for firms to sort of innovate in this area. And we make the example in the chapter of the carbon contracts for differences that was experimented on in Germany. And in a way, the way they decrease this regulatory uncertainty is thanks to these forward contracts on the price of abated greenhouse gases. And so, you know, again, let me stress that the design of these regulations and the consistency and the forward-looking nature of this type of measure is particularly important. Again, in this study that I mentioned before and that we report on in the chapter about the Dutch case, we see a similar importance of the forward-looking path of particular measure. We look at the Dutch carbon levy, and again, you know, we see that there is a very clear design looking forward that gives clear guidance to investors about what they can expect in the future. So absolutely yes on evaluation, absolutely yes on adaptation of policies to changing environment and also to the results of these evaluation exercises, but really this forward-looking and forward, I would say, aim to certainty is key for policy, especially in the carbon reduction area.
Yeah, the private sector knows how to deal with fluctuating prices, right? As long as they understand the mechanisms that generate this, that's important.
As we head into the last minutes of our podcast, can you both talk about some policy recommendations and your number one suggestions for policymakers?
I would say two recommendations. One is we need to design industrial policy, being mindful that it is a very powerful instrument, but it can be a very distortive instrument as well. So when using industrial policy, we need to make sure that we don't distort the competitive environment, because some of the innovations that we were mentioning might not be coming from incumbents, but might be coming from startups and might be coming from international players. So keeping a level playing field at home between incumbent and potential startups and globally across different countries, I think, is key. So, you know, we have to be very careful about this competitive neutrality of industrial policy. Second, and I think it's important to think of the design of our policies, and in particular in the area of green technology neutral policies do not exist. And we want to keep in mind that we want to foster radical innovation if we want to achieve climate neutrality by 2050. These, to me, are the two main messages.
Yes, that's a very difficult precursor, because I was basically going to say the same things, particularly because I also do believe that innovation is still playing a very crucial role here, and particularly for policy support. And if we really want to have the innovation machine working, we need particularly that open, competitive arena on a global scale here. So strategic autonomy is important, but can actually best reached within that open, competitive arena here, and definitely not closing it here. So we really have to be very careful with protectionism. And in that respect, I would also like to push the policymakers more towards really being more credible in terms of internationally collaborating on policy designs here. That's actually the best way to find a win-win, where everybody can generate strategic autonomy here in the most cost-efficient way.
As we go into all of these competitiveness reviews, which seems to be Europe's theme for the first half of 2024, do you think they're taking that message on board?
There is always a discussion on what you mean with competitiveness, and then competitiveness, if you really see this as my companies need to be able to do better than the others. but that's not the way in which we actually see competitiveness here. So firms really need to be able to develop long-term sustainable business models that will yield competitiveness on world markets. And that means access to open markets. And that means also collaborating with partners wherever necessary here, so that you can create value. And then also because of the uniqueness that you're offering into these value chains, that you actually can capture that value here. So competitiveness for me is not a zero-sum game. It's really all about creating a maximum positive sum game here.
Any final thoughts, Chiara?
I couldn't agree more with Renilde. Perhaps let me add another point that we made that goes in the same direction as Renilde. I mean, I think governments are all struggling with their financial situation and debt. And so we said it in our podcast before, it's not just about financial incentives, it's also about non-financial incentives. And I would say better coordination across countries actually might help and might, you know, be more than a zero-sum game and might really help both big but also especially smaller countries to really contribute to achieving this goal of climate neutrality in a much more efficient way. So coordination is important. Institutions like the OECD, the European Commission, can play an important role in helping this coordination across countries. And measuring and monitoring what we are doing is also a key part in this exercise.
Thank you so much, Chiara Criscuolo from the OECD, Reinhilde Voeglers from Bruegel. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and this has been an episode of The Sound of Economics. You can find all of our Bruegel's publications on our website, Bruegel.org. You can also go to the OECD's website to find many, many publications and statistics on these topics. And you can find this podcast on all your favorite channels. Thanks for joining us and hope to see you next time. Bye.